Hello, everybody, and welcome to Morgan Dorks. This is a bi-weekly Daria podcast where we take an in-depth look at our favorite animated teenage misanthrope episode by episode. I'm Rob Press.
And I'm Nissa Lee. And today we are looking at Season 2, Episode 10, Fair Enough, wherein a school-run Renaissance fair turns out to be a disaster for just about everybody involved. It aired on July 13th, 1998, and was written by Peggy Nichol. Last time we talked about Peggy was all about two episodes ago for Gifted, where she kind of blew us away and broke into our top 10.
Yeah.
Yeah. Prior to that, however, came The Lab Brat and The Daria Hunter. So who knows which Peggy might show up here?
A little bit of like preamble, I guess, but I don't think this episode is as bad as The Lab Rat or The Daria Hunter. I don't think it's as good as Gifted.
I'm going to agree with you there.
And that's going to wrap it up.
So. Yeah, all right.
All right, should we get into our beat by beat?
Yes, sir.
So we open on Daria in the library, getting her study on to the tune of Sunday by Sonic Youth. It's storming outside, and the roof is leaking. Daria packs up and leaves just in time to avoid a full roof collapse, like the building just straight drops.
She looks kind of like she's expecting it to happen.
Yeah, fully. And I wonder if she realized that Kevin and Brittany were in the building, because they definitely were. Mrs. Lee's purchase of a polygraph machine means the school won't have the money for repairs, so she decides Lawndale High will be holding a medieval fair, simulating life in the Middle Ages. The choice is to either volunteer, attend at the cost of $10, or get suspended. Thanks, Mrs. Lee. Jane convinces Daria to opt for attending, while Brittany and Kevin will apparently be volunteering in the fair's dinner theater rendition of the, quote, Cadbury Tales. Thank you, Brittany.
Yeah, I thought that was probably the best line.
Yeah, that was amazing. Kevin and Brittany get a lot of time in this episode, and all of it's pretty good.
Yeah, it is. Miss Lee says that she needs something that captures the student spirit of Lawndale High, and that's, That's this. That's a Renaissance fair. It's not what I expected, really.
No, not even a little.
I expected something more along the lines of like arts and crafts, art competition or something like that.
Right.
Or like everyone wearing school colors and selling candy.
Also, I understand how like school budgeting is a fickle thing and is often extremely, extremely tight. But I am baffled as to how the purchase of a polygraph machine makes it so that you suddenly don't have enough money to fix the roof of basically the entire building.
Well, it is a standalone building.
Yes.
So
it's a giant, very fancy looking standalone building. You're talking about millions of dollars of repairs there.
That is a very expensive polygraph machine, or it just like just pushed the budget over the edge.
It was the straw that broke the camel's back.
Did you notice that Daria, when she is in the library, is studying robber barons? And I have to think that's not a coincidence with Miss Lee's purchase of the polygraph machine.
No, that's very good work.
Yeah.
Oh, man. We talk fairly often about how these episodes just kind of like fly right into the plot, and this is totally no exception. It's a minute and 40 seconds into this thing, and we are already like off and running, and we know exactly what this episode is going to be about.
Yeah, and I love that. Like, I really love it. Yeah. It's artful, you know?
That's a great word for it. There absolutely is an art to making that happen without it just being like a rote and boring and, you know, downright cliche thing. Like, just being able to say, all right, no, here's what we're talking about, guys.
Right. And without the obligatory dinner at the Morgendorfer's, which sets everything up, you know,
yeah,
we don't have to do that. Although we do get a dinner.
Totally. This is a total tangent, but this reminds me of, there's a movie that I think I made you and Jeff sit down to watch at least part of this. There's a movie called Rubber. It's about a tire that becomes sentient.
Oh my God, yes.
And just starts like rolling around and killing things. And I have to encourage everybody who's listening to this, please at least watch like the first 15 minutes of Rubber. It's an amazing opening. The movie makes no sense whatsoever. It's a sentient tire. But the opening of the movie is a guy talking directly to you, the viewer, and saying, yeah, this isn't going to make any sense. It's a movie. Let's just chill. All right.
Just roll with it. Get it?
Okay, God damn it. All right. Great. Now we have to start everything over. Hello, everybody. And welcome to Morgendorf's. But yeah, it's just this great breaking of the fourth wall saying, look, chill out. This is going to be ridiculous. We're all here. And I feel like the beginning of a lot of Daria episodes could just straight up be like the writer of the episode sitting down and talking to you and saying, yeah, this one's going to be about hippies. All right, let's go.
Well, I feel like Miss Lee is the closest equivalent to that.
Yeah, definitely.
She
basically only shows up to deliver exposition.
But the most unbelievable exposition.
Yeah. I love the word artful for it. They keep finding new ways to go about it.
Yep.
So Quinn hears about Brittany and Kevin's plans, and she decides that for popularity's sake, she's going to get in on the shenanigans with Sprung Monkey's Get 'Em Out of Here playing in the background. At the Morgendorfer dinner that night, she announces she's auditioning for a role. Her parents are not even remotely interested. They're curious about what Daria is going to be doing at the fair. She says she's not going. And when pressed, she turns it around on Helen and Jake. So it seems like Quinn's going to end up having more of an audience than she hoped for.
It's really kind of weird that they aren't interested in what Quinn is doing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Helen just shrugs Quinn off entirely. Like, there's not even an attempt to say like, oh, that's great, Quinn, cool, you know, good for you. All right, because
she's doing something artsy.
I don't know. Maybe they're just kind of like sick of hearing, like, because Quinn's always up to something, so that's like not as inherently interesting, I guess.
Okay.
I'm not sure. I don't have any good answers for you. It's bad parenting, Nyssa.
all right.
Jake's balancing a bottle on his head throughout this scene.
Yeah, yeah. Fair point. Fair enough.
Hey. Now we have to start over.
No.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Morgendorks. Back at school, Sandy is in the middle of talking about her intention to avoid trying out for the play when Quinn drops by and says she's trying out for the play, prompting Sandy to reveal her intention to try out for the play. At home that night, Quinn asks Jake to help her rehearse her lines. Unfortunately, he's a broken human being, so that's kind of the end of that.
Oh, boy.
He goes into this giant monologue about how embarrassed he was when he was trying to play Guildenstern? Yes, Guildenstern.
Yes.
In a production that he was a part of earlier in the day.
Earlier in the day.
Yeah, earlier in the day. Back in the day.
It's a fresh wound.
Yeah. There's a fair amount going on here. One of the things that stands out, and it will be a recurring theme throughout this episode and has been a recurring theme throughout this season, Sandy is brutal with mm-hmm. Quinn.
She's a mean girl.
Yeah, she's a mean girl. Capital M, capital G.
So mean. What else is going on here?
There's an umbilical cord sculpture on Six Ad World.
Oh my God, it made me want a yartz. Just filled our quota.
I love Six Ad World so much. It's one of my favorite recurring gigs, and we get, much like we say yarts once an episode, there's a Six Ad World once an episode, and it's always one of the better jokes.
Yeah, and usually we don't even address it, but the umbilical cord sculpture is just, yeah.
So I initially remarked that between balancing a bottle on his head during the dinner discussion and just sort of drifting into a tangent about his own humiliating past, that Jake is being treated as kind of like vestigial to this whole thing. And you made a very good point about how this little tangent he goes off on is actually kind of central to what ends up happening.
Yeah, it plants this idea in the audience that, you know, Quinn could fail, right? I mean, mm-hmm. she's trying out for the Canterbury Tales because she wants to be among the popular kids. She wants to be the most popular in the show, right?
Right.
It's super shallow. She has never shown interest in theater before. And, you know, Jake, surprise, is interested in theater. Or has a past in theater.
He strikes me as pretty dramatic.
Just a tad. So like when he tells his story, he plants this notion that Quinn can fail despite the fact that she is doing this for the most shallow reason, right? Mm. That she doesn't really care about this. And failure and humiliation are totally a possibility here.
Yeah.
...
We're not really used to the concept of Quinn just crashing and burning either.
That's true. Yeah.
We've definitely had episodes where like she doesn't come out on top, you know, quote unquote. But,
right.
But we're not used to just utter failure.
Right. Like the episode where she is videotaped for.
Yes.
For an entire day, right?
Yes. They follow her around for a day and they create like a short film about her. And
what episode is that?
That's Monster.
Monster. Yes.
Yeah. And then she's watching from behind the door of the classroom and she falls into the classroom and somehow still ends up getting a round of applause.
Yeah.
That's just the life she leads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's totally believable, Quinn.
It's time for auditions. We are in the Lawndale High Auditorium, where everybody's practicing in the seats with Los Umbrellos' No Tango Dinero playing in the background. I don't know if it's Los Umbrellos.
It's probably Los Umbrellos. I don't know.
You said Umbrellos. Okay, whatever.
I don't know. I'm looking at it, and I'm like, I have no idea.
It's two L's in Spanish, right?
Right.
And that's a Y sound.
But it's also like the word umbrella. Yeah. I don't know the word for umbrella in Spanish.
Neither do I.
It's probably umbrello.
All right.
Hello, Google Translate. Google.
It's Googie. Thank you very much. Sandy, Upchuck, Quinn, Kevin, Brittany. It's really just the who's who out there auditioning. Upchuck gets fresh in a pretty gross way with Sandy during their audition, and he receives a swift kick to the jubblies for it. Brittany and Kevin are similarly distractible, of course, but Mr. O'Neill, who is in charge of this whole thing, naturally, sees something in Kevin's performance and asks him to stay on while Brittany is basically told to go pound sand. Things go from bad to worse for Brittany when it's revealed Quinn is the next up to audition and make out with Kevin.
So, Sandy, ball breaker, really keeping in character there.
Yeah, this is, I guess you could call it a good episode for Sandy, right?
Yeah.
You get to see, I mean, she has a mission, she sets out, she does it, she also defends herself against Upchuck's bullshit, which is pretty great. Always like to see an abuser get kicked in the nards.
Yep.
There's also a really, really great exchange between Mr. O'Neill and Kevin. Kevin's playing Palamon from the Canterbury Tales, and Mr. O'Neill, upon seeing Kevin's rendition of Palamon, says, "Kevin, you're doing something really special with Palamon." And Kevin replies, "But aren't I Palamon?"
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite Kevin lines. It's so good.
This scene reminds me of this year's model.
Yes, absolutely.
When Kevin is the star of the catwalk.
The auditorium is a good place for Kevin.
Yeah.
It's not a good place for basically anybody else, including Brittany. Brittany's had some bad times in this auditorium.
She really has. But at least this time she's doing something about it.
True.
Kind of getting ahead of ourselves here, but.
So, in the Morgendorfer Mobile, on the way to the fair, Quinn has gotten the part and is rehearsing her lines, much to the chagrin of Daria, who's being dragged along. In another, much speedier vehicle, Brittany has taken it upon herself to drive Kevin to the fair. So Kevin's not going to get to the fair. The Morgendorfers arrive at the fair to the tune of Jordan Knight's Give It to You, which was everywhere in 1998.
I'm not really sure I remember this one.
Oh, you would if you listened to it.
Yeah, probably.
And the Morgendorfers immediately lose their daughters. Helen and Jake run into Sandy's family, which is being its normal level of obnoxious. Helen and Linda, who, as a reminder, is Sandy's mom, share their ritual barbs, as they do. Elsewhere at the fair, Mr. DiMartino has posted up in the medieval jousting booth as the Black Knight and has basically found his true calling.
It's so perfect.
It really is. He is beating the crap out of students to the sounds of Cannabis's second round KO.
It's so awesome.
It's very, very good. It's something about this episode that works really well, and this is Peggy Nichol being kind of a genius with this stuff, is just how well folks transplant into this landscape. Like Mr. Yes. DiMartino as the Black Knight. Later we're going to see Upchuck as a jester, Ms. Barch as a fortune teller. It's a really great job.
I definitely agree. Like, Peggy Nichol knows these characters now.
Yes.
Now. The lab rat.
Oh, not so much.
It's taken some time.
And then the Daria Hunter, it was, what are characters? Who cares?
I think my favorite line from these scenes is Daria saying, "I will make a dainty garland for my neck and choke." Oh, man. So this is the line that Quinn says over and over again, rehearsing for her part.
Yeah, it's, "I will make a dainty garland for my head and sing."
Yes.
Is the line that Quinn repeats over and over. And if you remember anything from this episode when it aired, you probably remember that line because you hear it so many times. It is this episode's "Those paintball thingies hurt."
Yeah.
But yeah, that's Daria's response. "I will make a dainty garland for my neck and choke."
That's a strong garland.
It's an extraordinarily strong garland. I mean, they knew how to do these things back then.
Or just, you know, the will to choke is strong. Miss Lee here is maybe a little too excited about the possibility of an accidental death in the jousting booth. And the waivers that she gets everybody to sign to absolve Lawndale High of all responsibility. She's just a little too excited.
Yeah, well, I mean, if there is anything that is going to get Ms. Lee excited, it's bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm. True,
it's bureaucracy
true.
And the prospect of having one less student to feed.
Yep.
For the listeners, Nissa has thoughtfully stared off at the ceiling for a second. So Jane and Daria are making the rounds, Jane having agreed to come to Daria's rescue and needing to get out of the house anyway, as Trent has discovered a new cord.
Oh, I like that line. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's a great... They are approached and thoroughly unimpressed by Upchuck, who has also found his true calling, singing jester. Elsewhere, the economics teacher is getting the short end of the stick in the witch dunking booth. Jody is running the information desk. Mac is an evil dragon getting the crap kicked out of him by teenagers with Nerf sticks. Ms. Barch is a predictably dire fortune teller. Mm-hmm. and Sandy and Tiffany are running a cake stand. Everything is going according to plan.
Yeah, everything fits.
Ms. Barch as a fortune teller is such a good pull. Like, that's inspired stuff.
Yeah, I mean, Upchuck as the jester, like, you kind of saw it coming, but it just fits so well.
It absolutely does. And his song and Jane's response to his song is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to play a clip of that now.
Would either of you lovelies be interested in a madrigal?
No.
I am the brave Sir Chalk, manly and strong and quick.
I'm going to cut out your tongue, and fry it up on a stick.
Grrr, feisty. Hey, Andrea, you like madrigals?
Don't touch me, you howdy-doody looking creep.
I think that particularly the reason that Upchuck works as the jester in my mind is because, you know, the jester is that person in the court who can say anything to the king and probably not get killed for it. And Upchuck just keeps coming back.
Yeah. There's nobody takes him seriously.
No.
And he has a complete lack of shame.
Mm-hmm.
He's a silly outfit and a lute away from being a jester.
He's like that, you know, that inflatable toy, that inflatable, like, person that you knock down and it just gets back up.
The Weeble, I think is the...
Is that what it's called?
I know of the Weebles wobble, but they don't fall down, but I don't know if that's a thing. I don't know if that's the specific balloon person.
Okay.
Well, I know what you're talking about.
That's
though, yeah.
What Upchuck is.
He can't be defeated.
Yes.
He can only be knocked horizontal for a second.
And then he's back up in your face.
Yes. Much to your chagrin. Also, Upchuck runs off after Jane basically threatens to kill him. And he chases after Andrea, who finally gets a line.
Yeah.
It's the little goth girl in the background who's been totally silent the entire time. It's taken almost 2 full seasons, but she finally got a line.
Yeah, Andrea.
Yeah. Stacy approaches Sandy and Tiffany at the cake stand, bawling her eyes out, having just been rebuffed by the guy she thought she was dating. Her friends are less than comforting.
They're awful.
Yeah, they suck. The entire fashion club is just built on a house of lies.
Yes.
I mixed my metaphors there, but... But yeah, everyone's sniping at each other. Nobody cares about the other's well-being. Everyone's just a giant piece of shit.
Mm-hmm.
Mean girls, man.
Mean girls. Capital M, capital G.
So while they're barely pretending to try and comfort Stacy at all, Sandy catches sight of Quinn and appears to have something devious planned. Dari and Jane decide to get into the Ferris wheel to get away from it all, but they're jammed into the same car with Stacy, who is still sobbing uncontrollably.
So when I was reading the show notes, I had a realization. I never really thought about the phrase Ferris wheel and the fact that Ferris should be capitalized.
Yep.
Like, I'm pretty ashamed of this, as you know, having been a copy editor for quite some time. I guess I've just never had to read and write about Ferris wheels.
Yeah, you never think about it, but it's like Band-Aid or dumpster, like things that should be capitalized, but we don't really do it because we don't realize it. But yeah, I could be wrong, but I think Ferris was, I think the original Ferris wheel was designed for the Chicago World's Fair?
By a person named Ferris.
By a person named Ferris, yes. Yeah. It was invented by George Washington Ferris, a civil engineer from Illinois, who invented it in the 1890s for the 1893 Chicago World's Fair.
Good job.
Good on you, Mr. Ferris.
Thank you for your legacy.
You mentioned that Ms. Barch charges girls $2 for their fortunes, but she charges boys $20.
Yeah, that's perfect. Oh, and Stacy says that she wore her crushed velvet tank top to her date. So I'm just continuing the trend of me commenting on the fashion in this.
This is one that's... This is one that even caught my eye.
Yeah. Maybe that's why he didn't call her back. Maybe it was the crushed velvet.
Oh, poor Stacy.
She should have worn it to the Renaissance fair.
Yes, it would fit right in.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well. Maybe next time, Stacy. Maybe next time the library collapses, you can wear your crushed velvet tank top.
You know it will happen again.
Absolutely. Because Ms. Lee is going to cut corners.
Mm-hmm.
Elsewhere at the fair, someone had the brilliant idea to let Linda stand next to Helen while they were both holding bows and arrows. They're still sniping at one another, although not literally, for the time being. At the play, Helen's daughter is nervously rehearsing her line, while Linda's daughter is doing her best to sabotage everything through acts of elocutive terrorism. Meanwhile, Kevin's still in the car with Brittany, probably in Canada by now. The show's getting ready to start as everybody files in, including Helen and Jake, who are a bit put off by the fact that quote-unquote dinner is really just a big-ass turkey leg. Daria, Jane, and Stacy, meanwhile, won't be at the play because they're still stuck on the Ferris wheel, and Stacy is still losing it.
Woo.
I just want to get out there and say immediately that the big-ass turkey leg is basically the best thing about the Renaissance Fair, and I'm not going to hear anything to the contrary.
Yeah, it is pretty much a staple, and I'm really surprised that they just don't go along with it. Like, right?
It's just fun.
Yeah. Jake's line, what do you think happened to the rest of this turkey? There are a lot of good lines in this episode.
There really are. There's a lot of very good, like, quick quotable things. And he sounds so legitimately concerned when he says it. So yeah, when I mentioned elocutive terrorism, Sandy is trying to convince Quinn is struggling to figure out how she's going to pronounce her line, like what emphasis she's going to put on it. So she's saying like, I will make a dainty garland for my neck. And it's...
The pentameter's all off.
Yeah, everything is just a disaster. And Sandy comes by and just throws kerosene onto the fire and just watches as everything goes up. It's really a lot of fun. Like, it's terrible, but it's a lot of fun.
Now I'm just thinking about all these turkeys without their legs.
Well, they get their peg legs and they're fine. Or they get little carts. Like, you know, if you see a dog loses its back legs and they put like a little...
Yes.
You know, a little socket with wheels on it. Those are the turkeys.
They're in some booth, you know. some booth elsewhere in the Renaissance Fair.
Just a whole bunch of legless turkeys sitting around looking at each other like, you believe this shit?
Well, they're racing them.
It's like Ben-Hur, but louder and better. The apple really does not fall far from the tree with Linda and Sandy, does it?
No, we've talked about this before. They're like the same person.
Yeah.
But, you know, watching Linda and Helen go at it is just amazing.
Yeah. It's all the viciousness that you get from the fashion club.
But with intelligence as well.
Yeah. They've learned over the years how to be particularly snide and how to really bury their insults.
Yeah.
In some fantastically pointed ways. It's a lot of fun to watch. I feel like I'm coming around on this episode.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we were going into this, we were like, I don't know how I feel about this episode. Now these lines and... Yeah.
All right, so the curtain is about to open on the play, and Kevin is, of course, nowhere to be found. The three J's, all trying to impress Quinn, as they do, find out about this, and they vie for the part of Palamon. Jeffy is chosen at random by Mr. O'Neill, but immediately sabotaged by Jamie, who gives him the wrong set of lines to work with.
Who am I again? Oh, you're the partner.
You're the partner. Meanwhile, Sandy's sabotage has worked profoundly well, as when Quinn delivers her dainty garland line, well...
Make a dainty garland for my head and sing. La, 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 la.
Woof.
Uh-huh.
Jeffy, meanwhile, reads the wrong line because he thinks he's the partner, and things just go even further off the rails from there. Everybody starts laughing. Jake stands up, admirably, to defend his daughter, and is promptly pelted with a whole bunch of suddenly airborne turkey legs. The legs also drive Quinn off the stage, and everything devolves from there as Sandy and Linda sit in the front row just fucking stoked.
Mm-hmm. It's a pretty awesome scene.
It really is. It really is. I had never, until this moment, thought about how satisfying it would be to throw a turkey leg.
It would probably make a pretty gross sound, both leaving your hand and hitting its mark.
Absolutely. But it's got that, like, it's got that thin, you got that thin gripping handle, right? And then you got the weighted end, right?
Yeah. It's like it's an perfect axe.
Yeah. It's made to be a projectile. It's the only reason turkeys can fly.
It's their legs.
It's their legs. People don't think about that.
So the turkeys that are being raced at the other end of the Renaissance Fair can't fly.
No, but they're much faster on the ground because they have wheels.
Okay.
I think this makes perfect sense.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do we have anything... Do we have anything of substance to say about this set of scenes?
Well...
No, I feel like everyone's kind of acting...
I feel like everything in this episode has led up to this moment. It has been written so well that we expect everything. We expect everything that's going to happen in this episode, or in this scene, and... It's still satisfying.
You're right about that. And again, I didn't really think of this before, but like the way, you know, we had Quinn, as we mentioned, has been sort of set up to, you know, realize that this could go poorly for her. She's been nervous the entire time. She's been sabotaged by Sandy, who's also in the audience. We have Jake, who is similarly expecting that things could go badly, and he's reflecting on his own humiliating past. Mm-hmm. We have Mr. O'Neill not being able to find Kevin. Kevin's indisposed because Brittany's jealous of Quinn. And it's a whole thing. And Jeffy gets sabotaged by Jamie, and because Jeffy and Jamie both want Quinn. It really is kind of amazing.
Yeah.
How everything comes together just to explode.
Flying turkey legs.
Damn. Peggy Nichol.
Yeah. Busting the moves.
Yeah. So this... And maybe we can talk about this a little bit later, but like this episode doesn't strike me as ambitious as some of the other stuff that Peggy has done.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like when she's not trying to do something much bigger and much more grand than the basic Daria episode, she ends up knocking that basic Daria episode much further along.
Right. I think this episode is a typical... a classic Daria episode template that's being built on here. And she works so well in it. Every beat, you know?
Yeah. Man, it's crazy how often I'll go into a recording thinking one thing about an episode and come out of it thinking something else entirely.
Yeah. This is why it's good to talk about these things, right?
That's true. This is why it's not just the two of us writing essays and then coming together. Also, I mean, like, not to dive too far into what happens throughout the rest of the series, but Peggy Nichol does write a lot of very important episodes of Daria to come.
Well, I'm looking forward
to
that.
And she does them very, very well. Yeah. So what we are figuring out about this episode fits with what I think of the stuff that Peggy Nichol works on down the line.
Awesome.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool to see. In an area of the fair where things aren't rapidly descending into chaos, Jane, Daria, and Stacy are finally off the Ferris wheel. Woo-hoo! They convince Stacy to go call the guy, and she runs off. She's replaced immediately by Jody, who asks them to watch the information booth while she goes and finds Miss Lee because it appears there's a riot happening in the auditorium. A turkey riot. At the fortune teller booth, Miss Barch briefly comforts Mr. O'Neill with a somewhat nuanced fortune before, quote-unquote, comforting him with a somewhat less nuanced jumping of bones. To be fair, Casey and JoJo's All My Life was playing in the background, and it's impossible to not sex to that song. That's just how that works. That's what life in 1998 was like. This is how it happened.
I need to look that song up now.
This episode of Daria was a documentary, and the events happened in real time. At the information booth, Daria and Jane are dropping knowledge bombs about what medieval life was actually like, and it draws a gigantic crowd of fascinated children. They apparently do this well into the night. Meanwhile, Kevin and Brittany, still driving. And the credits roll to How Can You Expect to Be Taken Seriously by the Pet Shop Boys.
So, the first thing that I want to say about this scene... is really just a question. So this is not the first time that Jane and Daria have been made responsible for something, particularly by Jody, right? Jody puts them in charge of the information booth, but this is so familiar to me, and it's not the first time that she's done something like this. So what episode does she do this?
I don't know. I'm going through the episode list now, and I don't see anything.
And Jane says something very similar, like, someone has put us in charge of this, and they probably shouldn't have, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel like you're totally right. I also, I'm looking at the episode list, and I have no idea where that scene is.
I don't know.
So, I don't know. Hopefully a listener can clue us in on where that might be. Like, maybe they have an idea.
Yeah, please help us out. The other thing that I wanted to ask is, can you jog my memory of what Daria and Jane were saying about medieval life?
So they were talking about the impact of the Black Plague.
Okay, yeah.
They were talking about Anne Boleyn and what she actually looked like, which Jane's description of Anne Boleyn is apparently accurate.
Okay, where are you getting your sources for that?
So I looked it up after, because she said like she had this giant wart and she had like a sixth finger on her right hand or something like that. And I looked it up. Apparently the lady had like a sixth finger nail
okay,
on her right
that
hand.
That is different than a whole sixth finger. There was a man who had never met Anne Boleyn who wrote some of these things with a clear agenda. He was Catholic. Right? With a clear Catholic agenda, you know, saying that she had this, like, you know, that she had this extra finger, that she had a bunch of moles, which would have made her seem like a witch, you know, that she, you know, had this tooth protruding. I don't know. Yes, but there is that vestigial fingernail that's very possible. Very possible. But
see, I feel like if you're going to tell me you can have an extra finger or you can have just an extra fingernail, I'm going with extra finger.
Really?
Yeah. Because what the hell? Where? First of all, where's the extra fingernail? That's a huge part of the equation.
Yeah, I think hers was like on the side of her finger.
Yeah, that sucks.
Yeah.
Just have an extra finger.
Take up an instrument.
You can probably be a hell of an oboe player.
But what I'm saying is that, like, it's what they said about Anne Boleyn is probably not accurate and was probably Catholic propaganda.
Oh, man. Yeah. Do you want to write cultural context for now?
Just saying, you know.
No, hey, that's a good catch. That's a very good catch. I had no idea about that, and that's some awesome information. It's also really sad, but it's awesome information.
Well, the thing is that Anne Boleyn wasn't necessarily considered the most beautiful woman, because at that time, right, you know, fair-haired, fair-skinned women were like the pinnacle of beauty, and she was dark-haired, and she had like an olive tint to her skin or something like that. Mm-hmm. She had darker skin. You know, not like see-through. Like, not you can't see her veins. So, you know, she wasn't necessarily considered like an amazing beauty. So, mm-hmm, you know, that gets stretched to, you know, extra finger and huge growth on your neck.
And she doesn't have legs, she has wheels. Or she has a lot of turkey legs. One or the other, we're not sure.
Oh my God, yes.
This may get cut from the episode, but this is reminding me of, I was reading not too long ago about what's considered the first ever nude selfie that was sent to somebody else. And it was a painting from a lady in like the late 1800s. She was having like, I think she was having an affair with, or she wanted to have an affair with, this guy who was married. So she painted this very tiny, like we're talking like a couple inches by a couple inches, this very tiny but exceptionally well done picture of her chest. And then sent it to him.
Just the chest.
Yes, it's literally just that. It's just a pair of
the
boobs.
The first nitpick.
Yeah, totally. It's amazing. And that has, of course, survived through the years. And you can totally find pictures of it nowadays. I wish I could remember this lady's name.
Her boobs have survived time.
They have.
How many women can really say that?
There's so many answers to that question.
This is dangerous water.
Yeah. Do we really have anything else to say about the scene itself? I feel like we're kind of...
No.
It was kind of like a denouement, sort of.
Yeah.
Like all the really big important shit happened already, so.
It's a well-plotted episode.
Yeah. This is the falling action.
Yep.
So with that in mind, do we want to get into cultural context?
Wait, I have a question.
Uh-oh.
Did they raise enough money for the new library?
Almost certainly not. Like, it's a Renaissance fair. It was attended by the citizens of Lawndale.
Why don't they address this at all? I mean, that's what we started the episode with, is the library collapsing.
I'm telling it's you could replace the first minute and a half of the episode with Peggy Nichols sitting down in front of a camera and saying, look guys, this is what we're doing today, all right?
It's a Renaissance fair.
It's a Renaissance fair. Deal with it. You're gonna see some funny shit. Have fun.
Okay.
But no, that doesn't get resolved whatsoever.
Okay.
Dario was the only one using the library anyway, so all right. Now, do we want to go to our cultural context?
Yes.
So, if you grew up in the United States, you're probably pretty familiar with the concept and execution of Renaissance fairs. They're fairly ubiquitous around here. If you grew up outside of the United States, though, there's a chance you've hardly heard of these things. According to Wikipedia, the number of Renaissance fairs in the United States is around 62. Meanwhile, the number of such fairs throughout all of Europe is apparently only 12. That was kind of surprising to me. I had no idea that this was mostly an American thing.
You know, Jeff was telling me recently about a Renaissance-type fair in France, and I was so surprised by it because I was like, they have those?
So it's, I guess it didn't occur to me that, hey, if you guys kind of already lived through this, like, we didn't have a Renaissance period.
No.
So that's me being a stupid American. But that's just how I saw it. I didn't realize that it was a primarily American thing.
Yeah. So if you've never been to a Renaissance fair, it's a slightly more immersive experience than what was portrayed in this week's episode. A good Renaissance fair will take place out in the middle of nowhere and do its best to recreate a proper historical setting. Perhaps here is when we should mention some of the terminology we've been using. So, you know, we've been talking about medieval and Middle Ages. And
which is not really accurate.
Yeah. I guess you could technically say that the Middle Ages end with the Renaissance, you know, or towards the end of the Middle Ages is the Renaissance. But the Renaissance is more like a bridge between the Middle Ages and modern times.
Right.
With the Middle Ages being, you know, the dark times for literature and arts, and the Renaissance really turning that around.
Yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so at the Renaissance Fair, you'll have lots of people in costumes, lots of craftspeople selling their wares, a bunch of theatrical and musical acts, and tons of old-timey food, including, yes, full turkey legs.
Hell yeah.
And some ale, right? And, of course, mac and cheese. And french fries. Because, of course.
It's a staple.
Yeah.
Of Renaissance dining.
The period most of these fairs recreate is that of the English Renaissance, you know, which I said, you know, was a huge cultural shift that took place in England from the late 1400s to the early 1600s. We are most familiar with the Renaissance Fair in Pennsylvania, right?
Yep. We've been to that one.
You and together.
I. You, me, and mm-hmm. Jeff went to the Renaissance Fair. That's where I had my first turkey leg.
Was that your first Renaissance Fair?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
That's actually, to date, has been my only Renaissance Fair.
I've been going to Renaissance Fairs on and off probably since high school, maybe a little earlier than that. I have never, ever dressed up for one. Despite...
So that was the least surprising thing ever, followed by a pretty surprising thing.
You know, despite the discount for dressing up, I've never dressed up for one. Usually we're going when it's like so hot outside.
Yeah, yeah. And you don't want to be wearing all that fabric.
No, leave that to the actors.
They're used to feeling like death.
Under the spotlight of the sun.
So what we know as the Renaissance Fair has its roots in the early 1960s in the Los Angeles backyard of Phyllis Patterson, an English teacher and drama major, and her husband Ron, an art director. According to fairhistory.org, the official online home of the Patterson Family Archive, the couple put together after-school theater and art workshops in their backyard to encourage better and more engaging art education. This would soon evolve into the first actual fair, the Renaissance Pleasure Fair of Southern California, which opened its two-day run on May 11th, 1963, at Haskell's Rascals Ranch.
Haskell's Rascals Ranch.
It's amazing.
I love it. The early 60s in Southern California proved the perfect time and place for such an effort, and the thing took off like nobody's business. More than 50 years later, the Patterson family is still running the Renaissance Pleasure Fair. A commercial reenactment of the 1580s market fair at Port Deptford. It attracts around 250,000 people annually. It also has a lot of competition. Those previously mentioned 62 Renaissance fairs are scattered throughout the United States. They entertain millions upon millions every year.
It really is a big thing.
Yeah.
Like,
and growing, you know? I mean, there are tiny little Renaissance fairs everywhere as well.
Yeah,
the Pennsylvania Renaissance Fair is amazing.
Yeah, if you get the chance, definitely. Like, it's, even as someone who doesn't have a whole lot of, like, vested interest in Renaissance things and that time period in general, it's a really great, it's a lot of fun.
It is.
Like, there's something there for everybody.
I would say it's good, clean fun, but it's not good, clean fun.
No.
No.
No, it is not good, clean fun.
It is quite bawdy. My favorite act at the Pennsylvania Renaissance Fair is the duo of woo. It's two Scottish guys with a bunch of pickup lines. And it's amazing. Lots of kilt jokes.
Well, I mean, how can you not?
Lots of...
That's what the entirety of the song The Scotsman is
lots
about.
Lots of hips gyrating in the kilt.
Tell you what, though, they're the smartest ones there. Kilt, nice and cool. You get a good breeze.
Yep. Yeah, totally.
All right. So do we want to rank this episode?
Oh, yeah, I guess we should. Now that it's completely confused us. No. Confused isn't the right word. Well, confounded, perhaps.
Thrown us.
That doesn't sound like a phrase, no? You know when you, like, say the same thing over and over again?
Oh, yeah.
And it just suddenly doesn't sound like words? Mm-hmm. Thrown us has become that.
Thrown us. Now it sounds like one word.
Yes.
Like, I got a terrible pain in my thrown-us. So, I guess at the top, I'm not sure if I cut it or not, but at the top, we talked about how this episode was better than the Daria Hunter and better than the Lab Brat.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I think that's absolutely true. Okay. So, I guess my next question then is this as good as Gifted?
So, we ranked Gifted at number 9, as high as we did, because we liked the sincere moments between Jody and Daria.
Yes.
I like this episode because through and through, it is a Daria episode. you know, like I said earlier, it is like a true template of a Daria episode that's being built on here. And Peggy Nichols just hits every beat. It's just a solid episode. And I don't know how...
Everybody's acting the way that they should.
Yeah, the characterization everyone's is right involved. On. Yeah. Daria even gets, you know, her time, right?
Yeah. Like, we have come down on episodes for not having Daria be more of a driving factor.
Right.
In the plot, and I think this is one of those episodes. Like, Daria definitely takes a back seat.
She does. We get Quinn, though. Quinn is a little more central. But Daria is doing what we have come to understand Daria does best, is make mischief where she's not being watched, you know? School the little ones.
That's a
ones.
Really good way of putting it. Yeah.
School the little ones. While the adults aren't looking.
And yeah, one of the problems we had with Gifted, we didn't have a whole lot of issues with Gifted, but one of the things we did talk about was that how outside of those sincere moments, the episode itself kind of fell a little flat.
Ah, yeah.
Like, there wasn't a whole lot going on with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So when we talk about this being a very solid episode of Daria. All the characters are kind of on point. Everyone has a role to play. Things are, as we mentioned earlier, it's pretty It's tightly written. Mm-hmm. There is cause, there is effect, there are things that come back, there are things that we get early in the episode that play off, that actually play a part in the later parts of the episode, and we don't always have that in episodes of Daria. I'm looking now at 7 and 8. I'm looking at Too Cute and Monster. Mm-hmm. I hesitate to put this above Too Cute.
Mm-hmm.
I don't hesitate quite as much to put it above Monster.
So for me, I think that this episode, fair enough, falls right under Monster and right above Gifted. We really, really enjoyed Monster. It had this moment of self-awareness on Quinn's part where she's humiliated, but it turns around in a very typical Quinn way, you know?
Yes.
But we also, you know, have this moment where we realize, oh, Quinn knows what she's doing, you know?
Very much so.
And whereas this, you know, Quinn is, in fair enough, Quinn is humiliated, but we don't see much past that, you know? And right. If Quinn is going to be one of the central characters to this episode, I expected a little more. I mean, we did have Jake, you know, being Jake and projecting his trauma onto his daughter's experience, which was interesting. But that wasn't like the central part of it, I guess you could say.
It's an episode where the bad guys win, right?
Yeah.
Sandy gets her way. Quinn doesn't get her way. We're rooting for Quinn because Quinn's Quinn. And also Quinn's not trying to like actively screw with anybody else.
Yeah.
It's a good way to put it. It's inherently unsatisfying, but it's also like, if that's what you set out to write and you write that well.
She wrote it so well. Like this episode is written so well.
Yeah.
It's hard to put it above Gifted, you know, with its really good, you know, genuine moment.
Right.
But
as a cohesive work.
Yeah.
This show does a lot for, it takes all of the wonderful character moments that we get in Gifted and it spreads them out a little bit.
Yeah.
We get instead of incredible character moments from two of our characters, we get really good little character moments from like basically every character in the entire show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Everyone is who they should be in both,
yes,
you know, Daria land and Renaissance land.
All right. So we're saying then it goes in at number 9, under Monster and above Gifted.
Yes.
Okay. That works for me.
All right.
Cool. That was easy.
Yeah. Hey, guys. It's Rob's birthday today.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You should send him pictures of cats.
Okay. Yeah. Let's do that.
Or something.
That sounds fine.
Something Daria related, but with cats as well.
Hey, anything. Whatever. Go ahead. Text us. Tweet us. We're at MorganDorks. Send us your pictures of cats or Daria or cats and Daria. I don't care. Find something.
Happy birthday.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I try not to make a big deal of it every year.
But that's what I'm for.
Yeah. Everyone drags me kicking and screaming through the birthday experience.
Yes. We're almost at the end of this season.
Yes. This is flying by. And something I noticed going through stuff, doing show notes a little bit earlier this week, is we have an absolutely killer run of episodes coming up. We have See Jane Run, Pierce Me, Right Where It Hurts, and Through a Lens Darkly. Those are the final three episodes of season 2 and the first episode of season 3. Right Where It Hurts in particular, I cannot wait to do that episode with you in particular. I think I said in particular a lot. I can't wait to do that episode with
you.
You're going to love it.
Give me a reason.
So it's Daria working on a writing project. She has to try to write people she knows into a scenario And she goes through a whole bunch of different versions of that. And so we get to see what she writes for her group of friends Ooh. Over and over and over again. It's very funny. And it turns into something that's actually kind of touching and charming by the end of it. It's very well done. It's a Glenn Eichler season finale.
Ooh, okay.
That's, yeah.
All right. Something to look forward to.
Yeah. But we also have See Jane Run and Pierce Me and Through a Lens Darkly and all of those episodes. Like the next four episodes of Morgan Dirks are going to be so much fun.
Yeah.
Even more so than the usual fun that you get here at Morgan Dirks. All right, so we want to wrap this thing up. And that does about wrap it up for this episode of Morgan Dorks. As always, you know, check out our Patreon. That's at patreon.com/MorganDorks. Feel free to reach out to us on Twitter at MorganDorks, email us at MorganDorks@gmail.com, or check out our website, MorganDorks.podbean.com. That's PODBEAN.com. Also, we're on Facebook. That's FB.me/MorganDorks.podcast, or just search for it. It'll be much quicker for you.
Remember, guys, cats. Send pictures.
Cats.
Of cats.
Send cats. For the love of God, send cats.
Happy birthday, cats.
Happy birthday to the musical, Cats. special thanks, as always, to Outpost Daria Reborn. Link is in the show notes. And as always, thank you, Nissa.
Hey, Rob. Thank you. Thank you.
We'll see you all again in 2 weeks for Season 2, Episode 11, See Jane Run, here on Morgan Dorks.
Woot woot.